let's jump in because this is actually one of the two books that you had all asked to learn about when we did our survey about what we wanted to see. And so we're going to look at this. And I think that it is a timely book. I believe it's one that really fits the context of what we are going through right now. So I'm hoping you'll be encouraged this morning and challenged by it. So I want to begin. I want to pray that the Spirit would meet us in our homes where we are. So Lord, I pray for us this morning. Would you speak through your word, speak through your Holy Spirit? Would you open our eyes and our hearts to maybe something different or bigger than we might have seen? And would we end our time together feeling a greater connection with you and knowing that we're part of your family? And so it's in your name I pray. Amen. By the way, as a fun exercise, after you're done, if you go look at all the different churches in our area and all their Facebook live streams from this morning, you can see how everybody tries to have a different feel behind them. You have no idea how much time is probably spent deciding what is behind us. Because I just realized that I carefully placed myself here and forgot to turn on the fireplace behind me. So, hey, stuff like that happens. Hey, let me talk about Ruth. Really applicable to us. And if you have your Bibles out, if you look at Ruth chapter 1, it starts out, the whole story of Ruth starts out this way. It says, in the days when the judges ruled, and that's their way of saying this was in the period before Israel had a king. So this was back, if you remember, and you've been part of our series, this is roughly around the same time as Gideon. And so it's a time when they were a nation, they were in the promised land, but there was no king yet. So in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and his two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. There is so much wrapped up in that verse. Things that we would be really curious about, but it doesn't tell us. Because I couldn't help but read this in light of our current context. Because I wondered, that the author only says there was a famine in the land and that they had to move. And I wondered how many hundreds of conversations are contained in this verse. Like, I wonder how many sleepless nights. I wonder how many attempts that Naomi and her husband made to juggle their finances and said, you know what, we can just stick it out. We can make this work. We don't have to move. I wonder how many times they said, let's just wait one more week. I mean, one more week and it could be good. Or I wonder how many times they said, it's got to get better soon. I mean, the economy's got to improve. We don't have to go anywhere. I wonder how bad it got before they finally said, look, I mean, we got to go. We got to move. We cannot stay here anymore. And I wonder what went into the decision to go to Moab. Moab was the nation of Israel's enemies. This was not like going to a different place in Israel. They were leaving the country and going to a completely different culture and one that was opposite of theirs. And I wonder if in the end they said, hey, look, we got to go. But hey, we've got each other. We've got our kids. I mean, as long as we do this as a family, we're fine. And so they went. The problem was it didn't turn out well. And if you continue to read in the book of Ruth, they went to Moab and they lived there for about 10 years. But over the course of those 10 years, Naomi's husband passed away. So she's a widow. And it wasn't too much longer after that that her first son died and then her second son died. And now all of a sudden, Naomi's left with two daughter-in-laws and no hope. There was nothing to hold her in Moab any longer, and she had heard that the famine was over in Israel, so she said, well, you know what, I might as well go back to where I came from. And she went to her daughters-in-law, and she said, hey, look, ladies, you know, I love you, but there's nothing for you with me. You might as well stay here, meet new guys, you're young, get married, have families. If you come with me, you're just going to be widows who are the daughter-in-laws of another widow. And there's nothing for you. And it's interesting that one of them said, okay, and she stayed. You know, she loved her mother-in-law, but she stayed. But the other one, Ruth, refused to abandon her mother-in-law. In fact, we read this. She says, don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. This is in verse 16. Because where you go, I will go. Where you stay, I will stay. And your people will be my people and your God, my God. And where you die, I will die. It's quite a statement of loyalty, quite frankly. And so Naomi went back to Bethlehem. And at the very end of the first chapter, we get a sense for the state of the situation, because she comes back and some people recognize Naomi. It's been 10 years, but some of them recognize her. They remember her. And they kind of welcome her back. But she says this to them. She says, don't call me Naomi anymore. She says, call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life bitter. I went away full, husband, two kids, but the Lord brought me back empty. So why call me Naomi? The Lord afflicted me, and the Almighty has brought misfortune on me. Naomi's dreams of having a family, of having grandchildren, of having all those things had just been blown up. And she blamed God. She said, look, God did this. He could have treated me well, and he wrecked life for me. I mean, think about it. It wasn't going to look any better going forward. She lost 10 years of relationship. She couldn't just walk back in. She kind of had to reacquaint with everybody. There was no financial upside to where she was at, because widows and in that culture had to rely on the generosity of others. It's not like she could go out and get another job or work easily. So there was a lot of hardships in front of her. And everything she wanted, even though it was good, was gone. And I wonder how we respond to that. A lot of the current crisis that we're facing right now is all centered around this, because people are worried. They're fearful. They're fearful of losing their own health. They're fearful of having someone in their family die. They're fearful of the complications medically and otherwise that could happen. They're fearful that they're going to lose their job. They're fearful of not having enough money for the next paycheck. They're fearful of the retirement funds being sucked down. And for a lot of people today, it's like they can see the dreams they had swirling down the drain, or at least potentially. And I wonder, what do we do with all that? And so here's the main thought. And if you're following along in your outline, you can see it. The main idea that what I kind of wanted to settle with this morning is, in the midst of all this, I wonder that in the breaking of some of the dreams or thoughts or things we wish we had, that God is really opening us up to something bigger and something better. That our broken dreams are actually a prelude to better dreams and to something bigger. See, and when we talk a lot of times about the hope that we have and how we're going to get through this and God is there, but the hope that we have as Jesus followers, I think sometimes we get it messed up, because we think when we say hope, what we're really saying is, A, I hope, and Jesus is with me, that we'll get through this, everything will get back to normal, and I'll be able to have life the way I was before. And so we have this mistaken idea, I think, at times about something that God never promised, which is the whole reason that we're here is to live a comfortable life and have a good time. But I wonder, what if God's purpose for our life is different than ours? I mean, what if his values are different? What if his dream for our lives is different than the dream that I have for my life? What if God is doing something that I cannot so easily see? And I wonder if the broken dreams or the problems we have are a prelude to something bigger. So let's return to the story and see how it plays out. Because as the storyteller moves into chapter 2 in Ruth, we see a principle at work that even when things are bad, and maybe especially when things are bad, is true. And it's a principle we've talked about at Hope Chapel many, many times, but it's worth repeating. It's simply this, that God is at work even when it doesn't look like it. God is at work even when it doesn't look like it. Because in the midst of all this unknown, Naomi comes back, her dreams are shattered, her and Ruth, her daughter, are both widows. They don't know what the future holds. Everything's looking like a bleak. In the midst of all this, God is at work. But in order to see it, you'd have to change your perspective. And here's what I mean by that. One of the ways that we do that is by start looking for God in the so-called coincidences of life. Take a look at what happens, because we get a glimpse of God working through coincidences. At the very end, it says that Naomi returned from Moab accompanied by Ruth, arriving in Bethlehem just as the barley harvest is starting. That was a very key phrase. The author did that on purpose, because Naomi and Ruth are coming back at just the right time. I mean, food is plentiful. Jobs are there. It's the right time. People are more apt to be generous during this time. And because it's harvest time, Ruth actually has a chance to go out in the fields and work. I mean, it just so happens that they came back at the perfect time. Coincidence, right? But then there's coincidence in relationships, because we read in the first verse of the second chapter, now Naomi had a relative from her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing whose name was Boaz. So when she moves back, there just happens to be a relative of her dead husband, a noble man of high standing. And what made this an amazing coincidence is that Boaz is an eligible bachelor, single. And in Jewish law, there was a law called kinsman redeemer. You actually see this all the way through the book of Ruth, which basically means he's like a family guardian. He could, if he wanted, legally take over a deceased family's property and family. So it just happened to be where Boaz says. And then look at the places. This is amazing. It says in verse 2, Ruth said to Naomi, let me go out the fields and pick up some leftover grain behind anyone whose eyes I find favor. And Naomi said, go ahead. So you have to understand, this is what would happen. It was in the law. What widows and immigrants and anybody who was on the bottom end of the social ladder in that context, what they could do was they could go in the fields where they were harvesting grain. And what they do is they would walk behind the harvesters. And the law said that when they were harvesting, anything that fell to the ground was supposed to be left so that other people could pick it up. And so that's what Ruth was doing. So she went out, she began to glean in the fields of the harvesters, and it just turned out she found herself in a field belonging to Boaz. And just then, Boaz arrived. I mean, look at the coincidence in here. Ruth has no clue about anything. She's got no clue about the geography. She doesn't know anything about what's going on. She just wanders out. She just happens to find a field that just happens to belong to Boaz. And as she's there, Boaz just happens to show up and meet her and hear her story. It's amazing. The coincidences just begin to pile up. And I wonder if in the middle of all this, Ruth was beginning to think, hold on a second, some of this is too good to be true. God must be up to something. But I wonder if it's more than that too, because you know what a coincidence is? A coincidence is just simply when God does a miracle and he chooses to remain anonymous. That's what some people have called a coincidence. So pay attention. God might be working in the coincidences of your life. But there's a second part, because we also get a glimpse of him working in I would call them the really simple things, the things that might normally just go right past without knowing. Because Boaz actually encounters Ruth. He hears her story, and he says, hey, you know, stay here. Don't go around to other fields. A single young girl, especially if she's pretty, is really at risk if you're out there working in strangers' fields or with all these guys. So you know what, Ruth? Stay here. Just glean in my field. You can have the protection along with my servants of all my workers. I've already told my workers, leave you alone. So you can stay here, you can hang out, and so he's protecting her. He's giving her the protection that she wouldn't get anywhere else. And then he says, hey, by the way, whenever you're thirsty or hungry, you can go up and you can have drinks from the water that I have. I'm going to give you all the provisions. And then on top of all that, he went to his servants and he said, hey, by the way, when you're harvesting, drop a couple extra sheaves here and there. You know, don't make it obvious, but let her get more than she might normally. And so in the midst of all these things, he's providing protection. He's providing some extra income. He's giving her a little bit more. She's giving her a place. And they're small things, but they're huge because of where they're at. And I wonder sometimes, God is at work in the simple things, and we miss it because we're so focused on where our life and our dreams seem to be going. But God is at work in the simple things. And you wonder then, I think, at the end of that chapter, Naomi begins to see that God is up to something. Because Ruth comes back and she's like, well, how did you go? And she shows her all the grain she's got. She's like, that's amazing. How'd you get so much? And she goes, well, I found this guy. His name was Boaz. Naomi is like, that's amazing. I know who that guy is. This is the best possible place. And Naomi begins to say, you know what? My life's a mess, but I wonder if God is up to something. We need to watch where God is at work in the supposed coincidences and simple things of life. But it's when we get to chapter 3 that the real love story begins. And it's not like one of those Netflix romances. No, this is way deeper. It's way better. And in fact, in Scripture, a lot of times God uses love stories to not just show the story, but then also to show how God deals with his people. So they kind of form a dual function. So in chapter 3, it starts out with this very interesting little paragraph. It says, one day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, hey, my daughter, I must find a home for you. In other words, this isn't good. You're single, you're young. You got to find a place where you'll be well provided for. So now Boaz, that place you're working, you know, the guy with all the servants, you're working with the women and servants, he's a relative. So here's what I want you to do, Ruth. I want you to wash. I want you to put on perfume. I want you to put on your best clothes. And then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you're there until he's finished eating and drinking. So after the work of the day is done and he's, you know, they're having dinner, I want you to go and I want you to be ready. Don't let him see you. But when he lies down, note the place where he is lying and then go and uncover his feet and lie down and he will tell you what to do. Now, that seems weird because why would you lie down at anybody's feet? So there's a cultural thing in here that we could unpack about what this was all symbolic of. We don't really have time for that. But what was really going on was Naomi was saying to Ruth, hey, you need to go let Boaz know that you are available. That you, I mean, you are available, you're interested, you want this guy, you would love to have him in your life, so go make it known. And we read that and we go, oh, that's kind of sweet. But do you realize the extent of the risk that she was taking? She didn't know that Boaz was going to return her feelings. He could have rejected her outright. He could have been very indignant. Like, what are you doing? And why are you spending this? Like, get out. I don't think of you that way. You're way younger than me. You never know what could happen. Maybe he does fall in love, but he's way older than her. And the odds are he's going to die again, and then she's going to be widowed for a second time. I mean, they're looking their risks right in the face. And here's what I think is true, is that when we follow God, we're paying attention to these circumstances, these coincidences, these simple things that he's doing in our lives, in the midst of our dreams falling apart, that there is a sense that in order to follow along, we have to face the things that we fear. See, if we've been disappointed by God and our dreams have been broken, there's a reluctance sometimes to trust God because we're afraid of what he might bring into our life again. And there's a sense that if I trust, I could just get my heart broken again, and I have to face that fear in my life. And it doesn't matter sometimes if it's happened in the past and God has provided. It doesn't make it necessarily any easier in the current environment. And so as we face all these uncertainties that are in front of us, we think, well, I don't know. I'm fearful of these things. I don't know what's going to happen. We fear more pain. We fear exposure. We fear others. We fear failure. We fear not having enough money. We fear losing it all. And so I guess the question, and this is something that's in the notes later, is to ask yourself, what is it in the midst of all this that I am fearful of? It may not have anything to do with the virus, quite frankly. It might be other things. But what is the thing that causes you fear? What do you hope never happens? What do you hope, or if it did happen, would make you question everything? See, because we put a lot of energy in this life into making everything wonderful. I mean, that's what we do, right? You guys know this. We put a lot of effort into improving our homes and our families and our jobs. And we live under this assumption that we exist, like I said earlier, to have a good time. And we get deluded sometimes into these simplistic thinking that God's job is to assist us. Think of that particular light where we're at today. Here's something, and Larry Crabb wrote a book called Shattered Dreams. And in this book, here's what he wrote. He said, we conceive of the spiritual journey as a cooperative enterprise where we pool our resources with God's to see to it that life works well enough to keep us relatively happy till we reach the world where life works perfectly and we all feel great. So what ends up happening is we don't recognize the bigger dreams because we have all these little ones. And all the time God is saying, hey, look, the broken dreams that you have, the problems you're engaged with might actually be a prelude to something bigger. Because here's the thing. When it comes right down to it, broken dreams, things that we wanted that we didn't get, are necessary. They're essential if we want to experience spiritual renewal. Can't have it, really, without. Because as we finish chapter 3 and move into chapter 4 of Ruth, that's where it becomes really apparent that Boaz wants Ruth as much as Ruth wants Boaz. And I don't mean that kind of non-love, you know, that we see today. It's not that. Their passion is deeper. It's richer. It's more enduring than those fleeting lusts that we see on TV all the time. Boaz is going to do whatever it takes because he wants Ruth alongside him for life. So Jewish law basically said, hey, you can do this, but it always goes to the nearest relative first. And so there was Naomi had one other relative that was nearer than Boaz who had claim to the family, to all their stuff. But if they took it, they also had to, you know, take Ruth as the wife and take care of the whole family. So they have this whole meeting. And if you start chapter 4, it begins and he goes to the closer relative. The closer relative says, I would love to have anything that belongs to him, but I'm married. I got a business. I can't afford to take Ruth as a wife. I don't want to take the responsibility. So no, I'm going to pass. And so Boaz says, great, I will do it. I will take this family under my wing. I will take Ruth as my wife. I will take ownership of everything, their debts. I will take care of Naomi. And she had this marvelous connection. And we actually read this. This is how it ends. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. And the women said to Naomi, and it's interesting, they didn't say this to Ruth. They said it to Naomi, the grandmother. Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he, this grandson, become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, Ruth, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, that is not an indication that girls are better than boys or that daughters are better than sons, I don't think. But he says, hey, she's better. All those sons you so desperately want, she's been better than that, has given him birth. And then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. And so the story comes full circle, from bitterness to joy, from despair to hope. See, here's the thing. If we're going to experience renewal, if we're going to experience God, we need to expand our vision and how we see things. God is doing something far bigger than making us comfortable. That's something way too small to settle for. God has a bigger dream for us than we could ever imagine. God had a bigger dream for Naomi than she could have ever thought. And understand here, and this is really important, he did not restore her dream. Her husband was still dead. Her daughters, or her sons, were still dead. God didn't put all that back. He didn't say, we're just going to go back to the new normal. He said, no. That's gone. That's broken. You're never getting that back. But I got something bigger. God had this big plan, and you see it at the very, very end of the book in the last verses. We read this. The women living there said, Naomi has a son. Actually, and it was funny because they called it Naomi's son, even though it's Ruth's, because this was a big deal. And they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Do you realize that Ruth got to be the grandfather and Naomi the great, or grandmother and Naomi the great-grandmother of David, the greatest king that Israel ever saw, and more importantly, the line that gave us Jesus. See, broken dreams might actually be a prelude to something bigger. And so as we sit in the middle of all this with uncertainty and unknowns and financial issues and health problems potentially, and all these things on the horizon, it makes me wonder, maybe God is up to something bigger. Maybe he's more interested in your heart and in his mission than he is in your comfort and my comfort. Maybe he's more interested in seeing more people come into the kingdom than he is in us just loving the way we live our life in the midst of this with no thought for others. See, our broken dreams come in all shapes and sizes. They come from expectations that leave us wrestling with these feelings that we have. They come in the form of financial issues, relational issues, health issues, and they're all real. They're all relevant. I would never tell anybody, hey, just don't be afraid because God's got this. No, the fear is real. And we have to deal with it. But I think in the midst of it, if we start to realize that he has a bigger plan, we might find that helpful. Broken dreams might be a prelude to God's bigger dream. So suppose you were convinced, and I was convinced, that God is not committed to making our lives good and comfortable. And suppose we knew that the lesser dreams that cloud our souls and our minds from the greater dream, suppose that we knew that that happened, and suppose we understood that deep down inside we each craved or had that DNA that longs a connection with the Creator above all things. And that dream will only get fully released when these lesser dreams are broken. What would that change? So don't be fooled into thinking that Jesus is here to fill your dreams. There's a way bigger one, and he's bent on fulfilling it in you and through you, in us, through us. And we get to be a part of it. So let's make a practice together of seeing beyond our small dreams. And when all these dreams, in the midst of all this, when they begin to get broken, when they begin to get shattered, when they seem to go the direction we don't want them to go, then let's remember, God is at work. Look for him in the little coincidences and the small things, and know that these things are necessary for us to realize the bigger dream. Hey, broken dreams might actually be a prelude to something bigger.